evening sky.
I will show you a true summer,
Jariki said softly,
truer than any you have known.
The flecks of shining green began to flutter and coalesce, sparkling emerald fishes rising to the surface of a shadowy pond. Simon felt himself sinking into the mirror, although he did not move from where he leaned above it. The green became many greens, as many shades and tints as ever were. In a moment, they had resolved themselves into a startling confusion of bridges and towers and trees. A city and a forest grown together, sprouting as one in the midst of a grassy plain. Not a city a forest had grown over like Dai Chikiza, but a thriving, living amalgam of plant and polished stone, myrtle, jade, and viridian.
Enki shall say,
Jariki whispered. The grass on the plain bent luxuriantly before the wind. Scarlet, white, and sky-blue pennants fluttered like blossoms amid the city's branching spires.
The last and greatest city of the summer.
Where is it?
Simon breathed, astonished and bewitched by its beauty.
Not so much where, man-child, as when. The world is not only vaster than you know, Seoman. It is also far, far older. Enki'i Shao Se is long crumbled now. It lay east of the great forest.
Crumbled?
It was the last place where Zidaiya and Ikedaiya lived together, before the parting. It was a city of great craft and greater beauty. The very wind in the towers made music, and the lamps of night shone bright as stars. Neneyasu danced under moonlight by her forest pool, and the admiring trees leaned down to watch.
He shook his head slowly.
All gone. Those were the summer days of my people. We are now far into the autumn.
Gone?
Simon could still not grasp the tragedy. It seemed as though he could reach into the mirror, touch one of the needle-sharp towers with his finger. He felt tears struggling to break free. No home. The Scythi had lost their homes. They were lonely and homeless in the world. Jariki passed his hand over the glass, and it clouded.
Gone, he said. But as long as there is memory, summer remains, and even winter passes.
He turned and looked long at Simon, and the agonized expression on the youth's face at last brought a small, careful smile to his own.
Do not mourn so, he said,
and patted Simon's arm.
Brightness is not completely erased from the world. Not yet. And not all beautiful places have fallen to ruin. Still, there is Yao E Tenoke, the dwelling of my family and people. Perhaps someday, if we both come down safely from this mountain, you will see it.
He grinned his strange grin, thinking of something.
Perhaps you will.
The rest of the climb up Urmsheim, 3 more days on narrow, dangerous pathways, scarcely more than ice ribbons, over sheer glassy sheets by laboriously hacked hand and foot holes. 2 more nights of evil, teeth-grinding cold, passed by Simon like a fleeting but painful dream. Through the terrible weariness that beset him, he held on to Jariki's gift of summer, for it was a gift, he knew, and was comforted. Even as his numb fingers struggled to cling, and his numb feet to stay on the path, he thought that somewhere there would be warmth again, and something like a bed and clean clothes, even a bath would be welcome. All those things were out there somewhere. If he could just keep his head down and get off the mountain alive. When you stop to think about it, he reflected, there weren't many things in life one truly needed. To want too much was worse than greed. It was stupidity, a waste of precious time and effort. The company slowly worked their way around the body of the mountain until the sun rose each morning to shine over their right shoulders. The air was growing painfully thin, forcing frequent halts for the catching of breath. Even hardy Jariki and uncomplaining Anne were moving more slowly, limbs weighted as though by heavy garments. The human companions, except for the Trall, positively dragged. Grimrick had revived, thanks to the potency of Binnabik's Canluck elixir, but shivered and coughed as he climbed. From time to time, the wind increased, sending the clouds that hugged Ormsheim's shoulders flying like tattered ghosts. The mountain's silent neighbors would slowly materialize, jagged peaks holding lofty convention far above the surface of Ostenard, indifferent to the sordid and minuscule landscape at their feet. Binnabik, as comfortable breathing the insubstantial air of the roof of the world as he had been sitting in Naglaman's pantry, pointed out wide, craggy Mintahok in the east to his gasping companions, as well as several of the other mountains compassing the Troll Fells of Yikanok. They came upon it suddenly, while fully half the mountain's height still towered above them. Struggling over a rocky outcropping, the rope pulled taut as a bowstring between them, every breath burning their lungs, they heard one of the Scythi, who had climbed ahead and out of sight, let out a strange whistling cry. The companions scrambled toward the top with all possible haste. The question of what they were hurrying toward dangled unspoken. Binnabik, leading the line, stopped on the hill crest. He swayed a little to keep his balance.
"Daughter of the mountains!"
the Troll gasped, a plume of vapor rising from his mouth. He stood and did not move for long moments. Simon carefully mounted the last few steps. At first he saw nothing before him but another wide valley of snow, its white wall rising across from them, open on the right to the air and sky, and a succession of snowy cliffs that dropped away down the side of Ormsheim. He turned to Binnabik to ask what had made him cry out. The question died on his lips. On the left hand, the valley dug deep into the mountain's face, the valley floor sloping up as its high walls gradually angled together. At their apex, stretching up from the ground to the triangle of grey-blue sky, loomed the Uden tree.
"Elysia, Mother of God," Simon said, his voice cracking. "Mother of God," he repeated.
At first, confronted by the vast, mad implausibility of the thing, he thought it was a tree, a titanic tree of ice 1,000 feet tall, myriad branches sparkling and coruscating in the noonday sun, shadowed at its impossible summit by a halo of mist. It was only as he finally convinced himself it was real, that such a thing could exist in a world that also contained such mundane objects as pigs and fences and mixing bowls, that he began to understand what it was. A frozen waterfall, the accumulation of years of icy snowmelt captured in 1,000,000 icicles, a crystalline tracery down the jagged stone spine that formed the Uden tree's trunk. Jariki and Anne stood transfixed a few ells below the valley floor, staring up at the tree. Simon, following Binnabik, began struggling down the slope toward them, feeling the rope around his waist grow tense as Grimrick reached the summit and was himself struck motionless. Simon then waited patiently as the process was repeated 2 more times for Hasten and Sludig. At last, they all made their stumbling, preoccupied way down to the deep snow of the valley floor. The Scythi were quietly singing and paid no heed to the arrival of their human companions. For a long while, no one spoke. The majesty of the Uden tree almost seemed to suck the breath from their bodies. And for a great span of time, the companions just stood and stared, feeling emptied.
"Let us be going forward,"
Binnabik said at last. Simon started resentfully. The Troll's voice seemed a rude intrusion.
"'Tis the damnedest sight my eyes have ever held, Grimrick stuttered. Here, old Black One, I climbed to the stars, Sludig said quietly. God save me from blasphemy, but I can feel his presence still.
Binnabik started out across the open valley floor. The others followed after a few moments, tugged along by the troll's harness rope. The snow was thigh-deep and slow-going. After they had moved some 30 difficult steps, Simon finally tore his eyes from the spectacle to look back. Anne and Jeriki had not joined them. The two Scythi still stood side by side, as if waiting for something. They moved forward. The valley walls leaned ever closer above their heads, as though fascinated by these rare travelers. Simon could see that the base of the ice tree was a huge, jumbled, hole-dotted rockery, sheltered beneath the arching lower branches. Not true branches, but rather layer upon spreading layer of melted and refrozen icicles, each one wider than the one above, so that the bottommost branches made a ceiling half as wide as a tawny field over the strew of boulders. They had come close enough that the great ice pillar seemed to extend through the very roof of the sky. As he bent his neck painfully for one last glimpse at the near-vanished peak of the tree, a rush of surprise and fear ran over him, blackening his sight for a moment.
The tower! From my dreams! The tower with branches!
Stunned, he tripped and tumbled into the snow. Hasten reached down a broad hand and lifted him without a word. Simon chanced another look up, and a frightening sensation that was more than mere dizziness sluiced over him.
Binnabik! He cried.
The troll, just passing into the violet darkness of the Uden tree's shadow, turned swiftly.
Quiet, Simon! He hissed. We have no knowing if we may knock sharp ice loose, much to our regret.
Simon made his way forward through the clinging snow as quickly as he could.
Binnabik, this is the tower I dreamed. A white tower, with branches like a tree. This is it.
The troll surveyed the clutter of huge boulders and shattered rock in the tree's dark underside.
I thought it was your belief you saw Green Angel Tower from the Hayholt. I did. That is to say, it was part of both. But since I'd never seen this before, I didn't know that some of it was some of this. Do you understand?
Binnabik cocked a bushy black eyebrow.
When we are next finding time, I will cast the bones. Now we have a mission still unperformed.
He waited until the others had straggled up before speaking again.
It is my thought, he said at last, that we should be soon making a camp. Then we can spend the last hours of daylight hunting for some sign of Coleman's company. Or the sword, Thorn.
Are them, Hasten indicated the now distant Scythi, going to help?
Before Binnabik could voice an opinion, Grimrick whistled excitedly and pointed up at the jumble of rocks.
Look, you, he said, I think there's been someone staying here before. Look at the rocks there.
Simon followed the soldier's finger to a spot farther up the sloping pile of rocks, where several rows of stones had been piled in the mouth of one of the cave-like holes.
You're right, Hasten exclaimed. He's right. Sure as Tunas bones lie north to south, someone made themselves a camp there.
Careful,
Binnabik said urgently, but Simon had already shed his harness and was making his way up the scree, setting off tiny avalanches where he stepped incautiously. He reached the cave in short moments and stood, teetering on a loose stone.
This wall was made by men, that's certain, he called back excitedly.
The cavern mouth was perhaps 3 ells wide, and somebody had hurriedly but not unskillfully set rock to rock across the front, to keep in warmth, perhaps, to keep out animals.
Kindly do not shout, Simon, Binnabik said. We will be up directly with you.
Waiting impatiently, all thoughts of thin air and killing cold in abeyance, Simon watched the company climb after him. Even as Hasten began his clamber up the pile, the two Scythi appeared beneath the eaves of the Uden tree. After taking in the scene for a moment, They mounted up to the cave, as nimbly as branch-leaping squirrels. It took a moment for Simon's eyes to adjust to the more profound darkness inside the low cavern. When he could finally see, it took only a moment more for his eyes to widen with shock.
Pinnipec, it's there!
The troll, able to stand upright at his side where Simon crouched, brought the heel of his hand against his breastbone.
Kinkeeper, he said. They have been waiting for our coming.
The cave was scattered with the brown bones of men. The skeletons, naked but for fittings and jewelry of corroded black and green metal, sat propped against the cavern's walls. A thin layer of ice covered everything, like preserving glass.
Is it Cormand?
Simon asked.
Usiri, save us, Sludig choked behind him. Get out! The air must be poison!
There is no poison here,
Binnebeck chided him.
As to whether it is Sir Colman's party, the chances seem to me good.
It is interesting to wonder how they might have died.
Jirigi's voice was startlingly resonant in the small cavern.
If they froze, why did they not huddle together for warmth?
He indicated the scattering of the bodies about the chamber.
If they were killed by some animal or each other, then why are the bones arranged so carefully, as if each lay down to die in turn?
There are mysteries here worth much talking some day,
the troll responded.
But we have other duties, and light is failing fast.
All of you, Sludig said, his voice strained with some terrible urgency. Come here, here!
He stood over one of the skeletons. Although the bones had collapsed into a madder-colored heap, still it had the look of someone caught in the act of prayer, kneeling with arms outstretched. Between the bones of its two hands, which lay half-submerged in ice like stones in a bowl of milk, was a long bundle wrapped in frosted, rotting oilcloth. All the air suddenly seemed to leak out of the cavern. A taut, deadening silence fell on the company. The troll and the Rimmer's man kneeled, as if in imitation of the ancient bones, and began chipping away at the frozen bundle with their ice axes. The oilcloth came away in chips, like bark. A long strip splintered away to reveal a profound blackness beneath.
It's not metal, said Simon in disappointment.
Nor is thorn made of metal, Binnebeck grunted. Or of no metal you have ever been seeing.
Sludig was able to wiggle the point of his axe in beneath the petrified cloth, and with haste and straining help they tore loose another strip. Simon gasped. Binnebeck was right. This thing emerging like a jet-black butterfly from its prisoning chrysalis was not only a sword, it was a sword like no other he had ever seen. Long as a man's arm spread wide, fingertip to fingertip, and black. The purity of its blackness was unmarred by the colors that sparkled on its edge, as though the blade was so supernaturally sharp that it even sliced the dim light of the cavern into rainbows. Had it not been for the silver cord wrapped around the hilt as a hand grip, leaving the uncovered guard and pommel as pitchy as the rest of its length, it would have seemed to bear no relationship to mankind at all. Rather, despite its symmetry, it would have seemed some natural growth, some pure essence of nature's blackness extruded by chance in the form of an exquisite sword.
Thorn,
Binnebeck whispered, a sort of reverence coloring his satisfaction.
Thorn,
Jirigi repeated, and Simon could not even try to guess the thoughts behind his naming of the thing.
So this is it then, Sludig said at last. It is a beautiful thing. What could kill them with such a blade in their possession?
Who can know what happened to Cormand? Binnebeck said.
But even a sword like Thorn, you cannot eat when there is being no food.
They all continued to stare at the blade, Grimrick, who was closest to the cave mouth, at last straightened out his crouch, hugging himself with thin arms.
As the troll says, you can't eat swords. I'm going to make fire for the night.
He stepped outside the cavern and stood, stretching. He whistled a little. The tune, weak at first, grew stronger.
There is scrub brush in the rock crevices that might burn without kindling,
Sludic called after him. Hasten leaned forward, then touched the black blade with a cautious finger.
Gold, he smiled. No surprise that, is it?
He turned to Binnebik, oddly diffident.
May I lift it?
The troll nodded.
Carefully.
Hasten slipped his fingers gently under the cord-wrapped hilt and pulled, but the sword did not move.
Frozen, he guessed.
He tugged again, harder, with no better result.
Frozen up hard, tis.
He panted, pulling now with all his might. His breath rose in a cloud. Sludig leaned over to help him. Grimrick, outside the cavern, stopped whistling and said something unintelligible. As the Rimmer's man and the Erkinlander both heaved, the black sword at last began to move. But rather than snapping free of prisoning ice, the blade merely slid a little to one side, then stopped.
It is not frozen, Sludig gasped. It is as heavy as a millstone. We two together can barely move it.
How will we get it down the mountain, Binnebik?
Simon asked. He wanted to laugh. It was all so silly and strange. To find a magic sword and then not be able to carry it away. He reached his own hand forward and felt the deep, cool weight of the thing. And something else. A warming? Yes, some indefinable life beneath the cold surface, like a sleeping serpent stirring into wakefulness. Or was he imagining things? Binnebik stared at the immobile blade and scratched his shaggy hair, thinking. A moment later, Grimrick appeared in the cavern, waving his arms. As they turned to look at him, he slumped to his knees, then toppled over, limp as a sack of meal. A black arrow, a thorn of a different sort, quivered in his back. Blue light bathed the silver mask, touching its contours with pale fire. The face beneath had once been the model for its sculpted, inhuman beauty. But what the mask now covered, no living creature could say. The world had made uncountable revolutions since the face of Otoku had disappeared forever behind its gleaming lines. The blue-brushed mask turned and surveyed the giant, many-shadowed stone hall, eyeing her scurrying servitors as they labored to do all that she had bid them. Their voices were raised in songs of praise and remembrance. Their white hair fluttered in the eternal winds of the chamber of the harp. She listened with approval as the clatter of witchwood hammers echoed through the endless maze of corridors, riddling frozen Nakiga, the mountain the Norns called Mask of Tears. The mortals called her home Stormspike, and Otoku knew that it haunted their dreams, as it should. The silver face nodded, satisfied. All was in readiness. Suspended in the mist that crowned the great well, the harp suddenly moaned, a desolate sound like wind in the high passes. The Norn queen knew it was not his voice, not he who could make the breathing harp sing and howl, not he whose wrathful song sent the entire well chamber thundering with impossible musics. Some lesser voice was crawling through the harp, trapped in its infinite complexities like an insect in a sealed maze. She lifted a silver and white-gloved finger, mere inches above the black stone of her chair, and made a small gesture. The moan became louder, and something quivered into substantiality in the fog above the well. The grey sword, Jingizu, pulsing with painful light. Something held it, a shadowy figure, its hand a formless knot around Jingizu's hilt. Otoku understood. She did not have to see the supplicant. The sword was there, far more real than any mortal temporarily allowed to possess it.
Who comes before the queen of the Hikedaya?
She asked, knowing the answer full well.
Elias, High King of Austin Ard, the shadowy figure replied, I have decided to accept the terms of your master.
The word master nettled her.
Mortal, she said at last with queenly languor. What you wish will be given to you, but you have waited long, almost too long.
There were...
The shadowy thing holding the sword swayed, as if weary.
How fleshy, how weak these mortals were. How could they have caused such damage? I thought, it continued, that things would be different. Now I submit.
Of course you do. And you shall receive what was promised to you.
Thank you, O Queen, and I shall give you what I have promised in return.
Of course you will.
She lowered her gloved fingers, and the apparition vanished. Red light bloomed deep in the well as he came. As he took possession of it, the harp vibrated to a note of perfect triumph.
I don't want to die,
Grimrick wheezed, a froth of blood on his chin and cheek, his crooked teeth standing in his gaping mouth. He looked like a hare caught and savaged by hounds.
It's so bloody cold, he shivered.
Who did it?
Simon squeaked, losing control of his voice in shock and panic.
Whoever,
Hasten muttered, ashen-faced, as he bent over his stricken countryman.
They got us like coney up a plug hole. We must get out, Sludig snapped.
Wrap cloaks around arms, Binnivik said,
assembling his blowpipe from the pieces of his walking stick.
We are having no shields against arrows, but that will be some help.
Without a word, Jiriki stepped over Hasten and the fallen Grimrick, moving toward the mouth of the cave. Anne, tight-lipped, followed.
Prince Jiriki,
Binnivik began, but the Scythi paid no heed.
Come then, Sludig said. We cannot let them go out alone.
He snatched up his blade from the cloak where he had set it. Even as the others followed the Scythi to the cave mouth, Simon looked down at the black sword Thorn. They had come such a long way to find it. Were they to lose it now? What if they escaped, but were cut off from the cavern and could not come back? He put his hand on its hilt, and again felt the strange thrumming sensation. He tugged, and to his amazement, it came up in his hand. The weight of it was tremendous, but using two hands he was able to lift it off the frozen cave floor.
What was happening here?
He was dizzied. Two strong men could not lift it, but he could.
Magic?
Simon cautiously carried the long, achingly heavy blade to where his companion stood. Hasten untied his cloak, but instead of wrapping it around his arm for protection, he laid it gently over Grimrick. The wounded man coughed, bringing up more blood. Both Erkinlanders were crying. Before Simon could say a word about the sword, Jiriki strode from the cave mouth onto the rocky porch, cocky as a juggler.
Stand forward,
he shouted, and the icy walls of the valley sent the echoes tumbling back.
Who attacks the company of Prince Jiriki I Saonseri, son of Shima Onari and scion of the House of Year Dancing? Who would war on the Sidaya?
In answer, a dozen figures clambered down the sloping valley walls and stood 100 elves from the base of Uden Tree. All were armed, all wore glare masks and hooded white cloaks, and each bore on his breast the triangular badge of Storm Spike.
Norns?
Simon gasped, forgetting for an instant the strange object cradled in his arms.
These are not Hekedaya,
said Anne shortly.
They are mortals who do Otoku's bidding.
One of the cloaked men took a limping, stiff-legged pace forward. Simon recognized the sunburned skin and pale beard.
Go away, Zidaya,
Ingenjäger said. His voice was slow and cold.
The Queen's huntsman has no quarrel with you. It is those mortals cowering behind who have thwarted me.
and who cannot be allowed to leave this place.
They are under my protection, mortal man.
Prince Jiriki patted his sword.
Go back and sit beneath Otuku's table. You will get no scraps here.
Ingen Jaeger nodded.
So be it.
He waved a negligent hand, and one of his huntsmen swiftly drew his bow and fired. Jiriki sprang aside, pulling Sludig along, who had stood just at his back. The arrow shattered on a rock beside the cave mouth.
Down!
The prince shouted, even as Anne let fly an arrow in return. The huntsmen scattered, leaving one of their company face down in the snow. Simon and his companions went skittering down the slippery rocks to the base of the ice tree as arrows hummed past. Within minutes, both sides' meager ration of arrows had been exhausted. But not before Jiriki had feathered another of Ingen's raiders, putting a barb in the running man's eye as neatly as shooting an apple balanced on a stone wall. Nearby, Sludig was stricken in the fleshy part of his thigh, but the arrow had caromed off a stone first, and the Rimmer's man was able to pluck the head out and limp to shelter. Simon crouched behind a stone promontory, part of the Uden tree's trunk, cursing himself for leaving his bow and precious arrows in the cave. He watched as Anne, his own quiver exhausted, cast bow aside and pulled his slender dark sword from its sheath. The face of the Scyther was as implacable as if he had been mending fences. Simon was sure his own must be a mirror of his overwhelming inner fear, of his tripping heart and hollow stomach. He looked down at Thorn and felt a pulse of life in it. The heaviness had become different somehow, animate, as though it were full of rattling bees. It seemed a bound animal, stirring as it breathed the enticing scents of freedom. A short way to his left, on the far side of the stone trunk, Hasten and Sludig were slinking forward, using the great curving branches of ice for cover. Safe now from arrows, Ingen was gathering his huntsmen for a charge on the valley floor.
Simon!
A voice hissed. Startled, he turned around to see Binnebik crouching on the stone prominence above his head.
What will we do?
Simon asked, trying to keep his voice level but not succeeding. The troll, however, was staring down at the black length of thorn, nestled in Simon's arms like a child.
How?
Binnebik asked, his round face full of surprise.
I don't know. I only picked it up. I don't know. What are we going to do?
The troll shook his head.
You are now to stay right here. I am going to help with what I can. I wish that I had a spear.
He sprang down lightly, his heels spattering Simon with a flirt of gravel as he bounded past.
For Joshua Lackhand,
Hasten shouted and charged out from the eaves of the Uden tree onto the white valley floor, Sludig limping purposefully behind. As soon as they reached the deep snow, they slowed, as if running in treacle. Ingen's huntsmen slogged toward them, performing the same halting, deadly dance. Hasten swung up his heavy sword, but before he even reached the attackers, the first white-cloaked figure fell, clutching his throat.
Ikanok!
Binnebik shouted in triumph, then crouched to reload his blowpipe. The clang of swords reverberated as the first of Ingen's men reached Hasten and Sludig. The Scythi were there a moment later, moving nimbly over the snow, but still the companions were far outnumbered. A moment later, tall Hasten caught the flat of a blade on his hooded skull and went down in a puff of snow. Only Anne, leaping forward to stand over him, prevented his being skewered on the spot. Blades shimmered in the thin sunlight, and cries of pain and rage almost drowned the clash of metal. Simon saw with a sinking heart that Binnebik, whose remaining darts had proved useless against the thick cloaks of huntsmen, was pulling his long knife from his belt.
How can he be so brave? He's too small. They'll kill him before he can get close enough to use it. Binnebik!
He shouted and climbed to his feet. He lifted the heavy black sword over his head, feeling its great weight dragging at him even as he stumbled forward. The ground suddenly pitched beneath his feet. He staggered, spread-legged, and then felt the very mountain seem to sway. A rumbling screech pierced his ears, like the sound of a heavy stone dragged across a quarry. The combatants stopped, dumbfounded, and stared down at their feet. With another horrible shriek of tortured ice, the ground began to bulge. In the center of the valley floor, only a few cubits from where Ingen Jaeger stood gaping in horrible confusion, a great slab of ice pushed upward, cracking and buckling as it came, snow sliding off in great drifts. Propelled by the sudden shifting of the ground beneath him, Simon tripped and tumbled forward, holding tightly onto Thorn, and came to a stop virtually in the middle of the combatants. No one seemed to notice him. They were all frozen in place, as if the very ice of the Uden Tree had turned their blood to immobilizing frost, goggling at the impossible thing pushing its way up from beneath the snow. The Ice Dragon. A snake-like head as long as a man thrust out of the new-formed crevice, white-scaled above a toothy mouth, the staring eyes blue and occluded. It waved sinuously from side to side on its long neck, as though curiously observing the minute creatures who had awakened it from years-long slumber. Then, terrifyingly swift, it darted out and caught one of the huntsmen in its jaws, biting him in half and swallowing his legs. His crushed, blooded torso fell into the snow like a discarded rag.
"Igjartuk! It is Igjartuk!"
came Binnebik's thin shout. The gleaming ivory head snapped up another shrieking, white-cloaked morsel. As the rest scattered, their faces emptied by unthinking horror, splay-clawed white feet gripped the crevice's rim, and the dragon's long body, back covered with strange pale fur, yellowed as old parchment, humped slowly up from below. A whip-like tail, long as a jousting run, swept two of the huntsmen wailing into the pit. Simon sat stunned upon the snow, unable to force belief in the monstrous thing that crouched on the rim of the ice crevice, like a cat on a chair back. The long-snouted head dipped to regard him, and the murky, unblinking blue eyes fixed his with calm, ageless malice. His head throbbed, as though he tried to stare through water, those eyes hollow as glacial crevices. It saw him. It knew him in some way. It was as old as the bones of the mountains, as wise and cruel and uncaring as time itself. The jaws parted, and a sliver of black tongue knifed out, tasting the air. The head bobbed closer.
"Ski, spawn of Hinoebi," a voice shouted.
An instant later, Anne had vaulted onto the creature's hindquarters, grasping the thick fur for support. Singing, he lifted his sword and hacked at a scaly leg. Simon got to his feet and stumbled back, even as the dragon brought up its tail and smashed the scyther away. Anne flew 50 cubits to land crumpled in the snow at the valley's exposed rim, nothing beyond him but mist. Jiriki ran after with a cry of anger and despair.
"Simon!" the troll shouted. "Run! We can do nothing!"
Even as he spoke, the mist that had enshrouded Simon's wits began to clear. In a moment he was on his feet, flying after Jiriki. Binnebik, who had been perched on the crevice's far rim, flung himself backward as the dragon lashed out, and the great jaws snapped shut on nothing with a sound like an iron gate. The troll fell into a rift in the ice and disappeared. Jiriki huddled over the body of Anne, motionless as a statue. Pelting toward him, Simon looked back over his shoulder to see Igjarjuk slithering down from the broken battlement of ice and moving across the little valley, short legs gripping the ice as it wound along the ground, quickly narrowing the distance between itself and its stumbling prey. Simon tried to shout Jiriki's name, but his throat caught. All that came out was a strangled grunt. The scyther turned around. His amber eyes were bright. He climbed to his feet beside the body of his comrade, holding his long, rune-carved witchwood sword up before him.
"Come, old one," Jiriki cried. "Come to me and taste Indreju, you bastard child of Hinoebi."
Simon grimaced as he dug toward the prince. No need to shout, the dragon was coming of its own accord.
"Get behind,"
Jiriki started to say as Simon reached him. Then the scyther abruptly pitched forward. The snow beneath him had fallen away. Jiriki skidded backward toward the valley's edge and the empty distance beyond. Desperately, he reached out to grab at the snow. He stopped, clinging, his feet dangling over nothingness. Anne, a bloodied tangle, lay undisturbed a cubit away.
Jariki!
Simon stopped. There was a noise like thunder behind. He whirled to see the vast white bulk of Igjajuk bearing down, head flailing from side to side with the motion of the driving legs. Diving to one side, away from Jariki and Anne, he rolled and came up on his feet. The blue saucer eyes tracked him, and the creature, now only 100 paces away, swerved to follow. Simon realized he was still carrying Thorn. He lifted it up. It was suddenly light as a willow wand, and seemed to sing in his hands, like a wind-sawed rope. He glanced back over his shoulder. A few paces of ground was all, then empty air. One of the distant peaks hovered in the swirling mists across the chasm. White, quiet, serene.
Osiris, save me, he wondered. Why doesn't the dragon make a sound?
His mind seemed to float loose inside his body. One hand stole up to Miriamel's scarf at his throat, and then he grasped the silver-wrapped hilt once more. Igjajuk's head loomed, the gullet a black pit, the eye a blue lantern. The world seemed constructed of silence. What should he shout at the last?
He remembered what Jariki had once said of mortals. Even as the frosty murk of the dragon blew down on him, a stench like sour, cold earth and wet stones. Here I am, he cried, and brought Thorn whistling toward the baleful eye. I am Simon!
Something caught at the blade, and a gout of black blood spat at him, burning like fire, like ice, searing his face, even as a great white something crashed through and carried him down into darkness.
Chapter 43. The Harrowing. The robin, orange breast glinting like a fading ember, lighted on one of the elm's low branches. He turned his head slowly from side to side, surveying the herb garden, and chirped impatiently, as if displeased to find everything in such poor order. Joshua watched him fly away, dipping over the garden wall, then arching sharply upward to speed past the battlements of the inner keep. Within a moment he was a speck of black against the bright grey dawn.
The first robin I have seen in a very long time. Perhaps it is a hopeful sign in this dark Yuvan.
The prince turned, surprised, to see Yarnauga standing on the path, eyes fixed on the spot where the bird had disappeared. The old man, apparently unmindful of the cold, wore only breeches and a thin shirt. His white feet were bare.
Good morning, Tide, Yarnauga, Joshua said, pulling the neck of his cloak a little tighter, as if the Rimmer's man's unsusceptibility increased his own chill. What brings you out to the garden so early?
This old body needs very little sleep, Prince Joshua, he smiled, and I might ask you the same in turn. But I think I know the answer.
Joshua nodded morosely.
I have not slept well since I first entered my brother's dungeons. While my comfort has improved since then, worry has taken the place of hanging in chains as a denier of rest.
There are many kinds of imprisonment, Yarnauga nodded.
They walked quietly for a while through the maze of walkways. The garden was the Lady Vorshava's one-time pride, set out to her meticulous guidelines. For a girl born in a wagon, the prince's courtiers whispered she was certainly a stickler for elegance, but had now been allowed to deteriorate due to poor weather, as well as an abundance of more pressing concerns.
Something is amiss, Yarnauga, Joshua said at last. I can sense it. I can almost feel it.
As a fisherman feels the weather.
What is my brother doing?
It seems to me he is doing his best to kill us all, the old man replied, a tight grin creasing his leathery face. Is that what is amiss?
No, the prince said seriously. No, that is just the problem. We have held him off for a month, with bitter losses. Baron Ordmayer, Sir Grimstader, Waldo Kaner of Caldsay, as well as hundreds of stout yeomen. But it has been nearly a fortnight since he has mounted a serious assault. The attacks have been
cursory. He is going through the motions of a siege. Why?
He sat down on a low bench, and Yarnauga sat beside him.
Why?
He repeated.
A siege is not always won by force of arms. Perhaps he is planning to starve us out.
But then why bother to attack at all? We have inflicted terrible losses on them. Why not just wait?
It is as though he seeks only to keep us inside, and himself outside.
What is Elias doing?
The old man shrugged.
As I have told you, I can see much, but the insides of men's hearts are beyond my vision. We have survived so far. Let us be thankful.
I am. But I know my brother. He is not the type to sit patiently and wait. There is something in the wind. Some plan.
He trailed off into silence and sat staring at an overgrown bed of mock foil. The flowers had never opened, and weeds stood insolently among the twining stems, like carrion eaters mingling with a dying herd.
He could have been a magnificent king, you know,
Joshua said suddenly, as if in answer to some unspoken question. There was a time when he was just strong and not a bully. That is to say, he was sometimes cruel when we were younger. But it was only that innocent sort of cruelty that big boys show to the smaller ones. He even taught me some things. Swordplay, wrestling. I never taught him anything. He was not very interested in the things I knew about. The prince smiled sadly, and for a moment a child's fragile look seemed to shine through his close-paired features.
We might even have been friends.
The prince knitted his long fingers and blew warm breath into them.
If only Hylissa had lived.
Miriam Mel's mother?
Yarnauga asked quietly.
She was very beautiful. Southern, you know. Black hair, white teeth. She was very shy, but when she smiled, it was as though a lamp had been lit. And she loved my brother, as best she could. But he frightened her. So loud, so big. And she was very small, slim like a willow.
Jumped if one only touched her shoulder. The prince said no more, but sat lost in thought. Watery sunshine broke through the clouds on the horizon, bringing a little color to the drab garden.
You sound as though you thought much of her, the old man said gently.
Oh, I loved her.
Joshua's voice was matter of fact, his eyes still firmly fixed on the tangled mock foil.
I burned for love of her.
I prayed to God to take the love away, even though I knew that I would be but a husk, the living core of me scooped out. Not that my prayer did any good.
And I think she loved me too.
I was her only friend, she often said. No one else knew her as I did.
Did Elias suspect?
Of course. He suspected anyone who as much as stood near her at court pageants. And I was with her constantly, but always honorably, he added hurriedly, then stopped. Why should I be so earnest about that, even now?
Osiris, forgive me, I wish we had betrayed him. Joshua's teeth were clenched.
I wish you were my dead lover, instead of only my brother's dead wife.
He stared accusingly at the knob of scarred flesh protruding from his right sleeve. Her death lies on my conscience like a great stone.
It was my fault.
My God, we are a haunted family.
He broke off at the clatter of footsteps on the path.
Prince Joshua! Prince Joshua, where are you?
Here, the prince called distractedly, and a moment later one of his guards stumbled into view around a hedge wall.
My prince, he gasped, bending a knee. Sir Deonoth says you must come at once.
Are they onto the walls again? Joshua asked, standing and shaking dew from his wool cloak. His voice still sounded distant.
No, sire, the guard said, his moustached mouth opening and closing in excitement as though he were a whiskered fish. It's your brother. I mean the king, sire. He's pulling back. The siege is ending.
The prince gave Yarnauga a puzzled, worried glance as they hurried up the path behind the excited guard.
"The High King has given over!" Deornoth shouted as Joshua made his way up the steps, cloak billowing in the wind. "See? He turns tail and runs."
Deornoth turned and gave Asorn a comradely smack on the shoulder. The Duke's son grinned, but Einskaldir beside him glared fiercely at the young Erkinlander, lest he should think to try anything so foolish on him.
"What now? What?"
Joshua said, pushing up beside Deornoth on the sagging curtain wall. Directly below them lay the shattered ruins of a miner's box, evidence of a futile attempt to drop the curtain wall by tunneling beneath it. The wall had dipped a few feet, but held. Dendinus had built for the ages. The miners, even as they had set fire to the wooden pillars shoring their tunnel, had been felled by the few stones they had themselves shaken loose. In the distance lay Elias' camp, an anthill of scurrying activity. The remaining siege engines had been toppled and shattered, so that they would benefit no one else. The rows and rows of tents had vanished, as if swept up and carried away by gale winds. Thin sounds, the distant cry of drovers, the crack of whips, floated up as the High King's wagons were loaded.
"He is retreating," Deornoth said happily. "We have done it."
Joshua shook his head.
"Why? Why should he? We have whittled away a bare fraction of his troops.
Perhaps he realizes now how strong Naglamund is," Isorn said, squinting.
"Then why not wait us out?" the prince demanded. "Aiden, what goes on here? I can believe Elias himself might go back to the Hayholt, but why not leave even a token siege in place?"
"To lure us out," Einskaldir said quietly, "onto open ground."
Scowling, he rubbed a rough thumb over the blade of his knife.
"It could be," the prince said, "but he should know me better."
"Joshua."
Yarnauga was looking out beyond the decamping army, into the morning haze cloaking the northern horizon.
"There are strange clouds away to the north."
The others stared, but could see nothing but the dim beginnings of the frost march.
"What sort of clouds?" the prince asked at last.
"Storm clouds. Very strange. Like none I have ever seen south of the mountains."
The prince stood at the window listening to the murmur of the trailing wind, his forehead pressed against the cold stone frame. The spare courtyard below was moon-painted, and the trees swayed. Vorsheva extended a white arm from beneath the fur coverlet.
"Joshua, what is it? It is cold. Shut the window and come back to your bed."
He did not turn.
"The wind goes everywhere," he said quietly. "There is no keeping it out, and there is no staying it when it wishes to depart."
"It is too late at night for your riddles, Joshua," she said,
yawning and running fingers through her inky hair, so that it spread upon the sheet like black wings.
"It is perhaps too late for many things," he replied,
and went to sit on the bed beside her. His hand gently stroked her long neck, but still he looked out toward the window.
"I am sorry, Vorsheva. I am confusing, I know. I have never been the right man, not for my tutors, not for my brother or my father, and not for you. I sometimes wonder if I was born out of my time."
He lifted his finger to trace her cheek, and her warm breath was on his hand.
"When I see the world as it has been presented to me, I feel only a deep loneliness."
"Lonely?"
Vorsheva sat up. The fur robe fell away. Her smooth ivory skin was banded in moonlight.
"By my clan, Joshua, you are a cruel man. Still you punish me for my mistake in trying to help the princess. How can you share my bed and call yourself lonely? Go away, you moping boy. Go sleep with one of those cold northern girls or in some monk's den. Go then."
She struck at him, and he caught her arm. She was strong despite her slenderness, and she slapped him twice with her other hand before he could roll atop her and pinion her.
"Peace, lady, peace," he said, and then laughed, although his face stung.
Vosheva scowled and struggled. "You are right," he said. "I have done you insult, and I ask your apology. I sue for peace."
He leaned down, kissed her on the neck, and then again on her anger-reddened cheek.
"Come nearer, and I will bite you,"
she hissed. Her body trembled against his.
"I was frightened for you when you went to battle, Joshua. I thought you would die."
"I was no less frightened, my lady. There is much in the world to fear."
"And now you feel you are alone?"
"One can be lonely," the prince said, offering his lip to be bitten, "in the highest and best of company." Her arm, now free, closed around his neck to pull him closer. The moonlight silvered their intertwined limbs. Joshua dropped his bone spoon back into the soup bowl and angrily watched the small eddies wash back and forth across the surface. The dining hall hummed with the rush of many voices.
"I cannot eat. I must know."
Vosheva, eating in silence but with her usual good appetite, shot him a disquieted glance down the table.
"Whatever is happening, my prince," de Ornoth said shyly, "you must have your strength."
"You will need it to speak to your people, Prince Joshua,"
Isorn commented around a mouthful of bread.
"They are upset and puzzled. The king is gone. Why no celebration?"
"You know damnably well why not,"
Joshua snapped, then raised his hand to his temple in pain.
"Surely you can see it is some trap, that Elias would not give up so easily."
"I suppose," said Isorn, but did not seem convinced.